This is Ozarks at Large for Wednesday, October 2nd, 2013. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And I'm Kyle Kellums. Ozarks at Large is underwritten in part by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. If you have Alzheimer's disease or think you may have Alzheimer's disease, Health Initiatives Research is seeking participants to evaluate the effectiveness and safety of an oral study drug that may slow the progression of mild to moderate Alzheimer's disease. More information is available at 871-1771.
Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, the effects of the current farm bill expiring. An agricultural economist tells us which groups will be affected soon if Congress doesn't take action. And researchers with ties to the University of Arkansas discover a new organism.
Plus, Lake Keith in Cave Springs gets a makeover, an ice cream maker is bringing pure joy to the region, and more.
But first, the Arkansas Insurance Department's open enrollment kickoff happened yesterday at the Clinton School of Public Service. Eligible Arkansans between the ages of 18 and 64 can sign up for one of 71 plans through the newly established insurance marketplace. Sherry Booth, a trained and licensed marketplace guide, says they have run into technical difficulties because so many people are trying to access the enrollment website.
You can get in, as you can see, through the marketplace. However, getting past the system that we don't, you know, we're having a few issues with that. In other words, traffic on that website is so busy right now.
The licensed marketplace guides assured visitors the site is simply backed up and will be available soon. The insurance department partnered with the Clinton School to host the event to help people learn how much financial assistance they qualify for. Insurance Department Exchange Planning Manager Cynthia Crone with the department says an overwhelming response kept the enrollment website down much of the day.
The not great news is that we haven't been able to enroll a lot of people today. The good news is the interest, people are getting educated, and that we really have until December 15th for people to enroll to get the full benefits starting January 1, 14.
The website, arhealthconnector.org, had more than 17,000 visitors yesterday.
Yesterday, we brought you a report on how the federal government shutdown is affecting operations at Beaver Lake. The shutdown is also affecting national wildlife refuges across the country. Keith Weaver is the project leader for the Central Arkansas National Wildlife Refuge National Wildlife Refuge Complex.
The immediate impacts are the fact that all the national wildlife refuges in Arkansas will be closed to public access, and any types of activities that would be conducted on those, any types of public use activities that would be conducted on those lands are canceled at the present time.
Those public use activities include hunting and fishing, wildlife observation and photography, and environmental education and interpretation. Weaver says the only activities that will continue at the state's 10 wildlife refuges are forestry management, such as pending timber sales and cooperative farming activities. He says a lengthy shutdown could have a spiral of consequences.
Certainly, I think the users of the National Wildlife Refuge system will be impacted in terms of loss of opportunity to recreate on those national wildlife refuges, and I think there's a spin-off in terms of businesses and revenues to local businesses for visitors that are coming to a national wildlife refuge will often pass through communities and will spend monies in those communities associated with their trips to the national wildlife refuge lands.
Weaver says in 2011, a survey was conducted to determine the economic impact of hunting, fishing, and wildlife observation on lands not exclusively included in national wildlife refuges. Nevertheless, in that year, people older than 16 years of age who participated in those activities spent approximately $681 million on trip-related expenses.
One area that won't be affected by the government shutdown, at least in the near future, is research and development at the University of Arkansas. Jim Rankin, Vice Provost for Research and Economic Development at the U of A, says the university has been told it can continue its research for projects that have already received funding.
We do get quite a significant amount of federal funding, and some of these are, you know, one-year grants, two-year grants, and so they're not always tied to the federal fiscal year, which started October 1st. So they could have at least a year of funding in their account. So we won't see an immediate impact, but you'll start seeing one or two that start running out of funding.
Rankin says some of the other side effects of the federal shutdown are already being felt. For instance, the National Institute of Health isn't taking any new applications for grant funding, meaning researchers at the university have proposals waiting for when government operations continue. In addition, if a federal employee or facility is involved in a particular research project, that employee or facility won't be available during the shutdown. And Rankin says the current federal shutdown has brought with it less immediate uncertainty to the research world than the federal sequester did earlier in the year.
In that case, we weren't quite sure what was going to happen, what kind of impact we had. Each agency had a certain percentage they had to cut, and we didn't know if specific grants were going to be cut, so we were a little bit unknown in that particular situation. In this one, the guidance just tells us go ahead and do the research as long as you have funds. And so we've kind of got a better feeling. I think the big question on this time is how long it's going to last.
But Rankin says he's hopeful the shutdown will be short so the research world can get back to business as usual.
The Arkansas Department of Health is working with law enforcement throughout the state to curb prescription drug abuse. Yesterday, a statewide program that provides drop boxes for drug disposal was expanded with an additional 60 boxes. Health Department spokesman Ed Barham says the program is needed.
We see about one death per day in Arkansas as a result of prescription drug overdoses. And we know that most young people who use drugs like that get them from the home medicine chest. So this is a good way for people who have drugs they no longer need to get them out of harm's way.
Barham says the program has helped collect more than 32 tons of medicines. The drop boxes are primarily located at police and sheriff stations.
The School of Law at the University of Arkansas is one of the best values for a law degree in the nation. That's according to the National Jurists Annual Ranking of Best Value Law Schools. This is the third year that the School of Law has been named in the publication's top 20 best value schools, ranking second in this year's rankings. Last year, the school was ranked 14th on the list. The National Jurist ranks schools based on percentage of graduates who pass the bar exam, employment rate, tuition, cost of living, and average indebtedness upon graduation.
Mostly cloudy tonight. Lows will be in the mid-60s in northwest Arkansas, 68 for the Arkansas River Valley. Partly sunny tomorrow, highs from 85 to 89. Tomorrow night, partly cloudy, lows in the mid-60s. This is Ozarks at Large. With the U.S. Congress focusing its attention recently on keeping the federal government open for business, one piece of legislation that has been neglected is the Farm Bill. It provides many different titles for farmers and food producers across the country. As Ozarks at Large's Timothy Dennis reports, the government shutdown happened as the current Farm Bill expired.
With the end of the fiscal year came the end to the Farm Bill extension, which was passed earlier this year. As such, the bill reverts back to provisions set in the bill's original passage in 1949. Eric Wales is an agricultural economist at the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville. He says that while the bill's expiration isn't extremely dire overall, certain groups will feel the implications soon if action isn't taken by Congress.
So current policy is basically following out on the extension because the Farm Bill is basically implemented through a crop year basis. So I guess one could say it's certainly important for the dairy farmers because the payment mechanism for particularly smaller dairy farms is terminated with the expiration of this bill. But the other people who will be impacted right now because of the uncertainty are probably people who are putting in fall crops for, let's say, spring harvest, such as winter wheat.
Wales says that current uncertainty exists because of the fact that while the framework for a long-term farm bill does exist, legislative inaction leaves producers not knowing when that long-term legislation will take effect or even what it will include. He says that while the current farm bill includes multifarious provisions for everything from farm subsidies to markets development and conservation titles, Wales says that there are a few titles in particular that would benefit Arkansas farmers if included in a new farm bill or even an extension to the recently expired farm bill.
Certainly the commodity title, which basically provides support in terms of price and income loss, or what they call revenue loss support, that's an important one. It's particularly important for the crop producers in the eastern part of the state. The conservation title is important because it includes a lot of both land retirement programs, such as the Conservation Reserve Program, but also what they call working lands programs, such as EQIP, which is an environmental quality incentive program to incentivize farmers to adopt stewardship plans and activities on their farms to improve the sustainability of their operations.
Another farm bill provision that Wells says is of particular importance to Arkansas farmers is the crop insurance program.
What the current both House and Senate proposals are doing is sort of shifting the way that the government supports producers, particularly crop producers, shifting away from price and income or revenue losses towards increasing subsidies for crop insurance. And as such, Arkansas traditionally has not been a large purchaser of crop insurance to a large extent because so much of our crops are irrigated, so we don't have a lot of yield risk with Arkansas production. And the risks in Arkansas are primarily on the price side and on the cost side, just because of the pumping costs associated with irrigation.
And yet another title in the Farm Bill that has implications for Arkansans is the nutrition title for SNAP benefits, formerly known as food stamps. While both houses of Congress have passed separate versions of an updated farm bill in recent months, the House initially separated the SNAP program from its version of the bill. But last week, representatives added a revised nutrition title back into the House bill for consideration when the bills are eventually taken into conference to reconcile the differences. But between the two versions of the bill as they currently stand, which is better for the agricultural economy of Arkansas?
And our analysis basically shows that on the House side, the commodity title favors Arkansas relative to the Senate, although the Senate bill is much improved in the 2013 version compared to the version that they brought out in 2012. So as you may well know, this has been now 2 years that they've tried to produce a farm bill, and they're still at it. And so hopefully we're going to be able to go beyond an extension of the current program and get these reforms put into place so that farmers have some certainty over the next 5 years.
But worst case scenario, if Congress doesn't pass at least an extension to the most current farm bill by the start of the next crop season, Wales says that the provisions of the 1949 farm bill could have strange implications for the major crops of Arkansas.
For example, you know, Arkansas is the number one crop in terms of acreage is soybeans, and there's no program to help stabilize soybean prices or revenue in the 1949 legislation. Soybeans were a relatively new crop then and weren't even part of the commodity program. The wheat, for example, then was managed under a strict quota production system, and that would have to be instituted and implemented, and I don't know how they would begin to allocate that. The rice program was driven by a production allotment system.
Wales says that the permanent farm bill is in place to act as a framework for Congress to update every 5 years as circumstances change. And though this is the first time that Congress has failed to pass an updated or even extended farm bill, it isn't the first time that the farm bill has hit roadblocks to passage.
President Bush, he vetoed the 2002 Farm Bill, I think twice, but we've always had a bipartisan approach to developing and passing this Farm Bill, and only in this year when we have such an acrimonious, extreme set of elements operating in Congress have we just drawn to a standstill in terms of trying to move forward on what otherwise would be pretty sensible and reasonable reforms that would help with the budget reduction and also just give some certainty not only to producers but also to households who are dependent upon on the supplemental nutrition program.
But any conference to consider the Farm Bill will have to wait until after Congress comes to an agreement on a continuing resolution to fund the overall federal government and after governmental agencies, including the U.S. Department of Agriculture, reopen. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Timothy Dennis.
Historic Lake Keith in downtown Cave Springs is getting a major makeover. As Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports, the 6-acre reservoir is being emptied to make way for construction of a brand new environmental center planned by the Illinois River Watershed Partnership.
Arkansas Game and Fish Commission construction crew from Calico Rock and diving gear stand 15 feet deep inside an ancient concrete box surrounded by spewing water, working to free a frozen water outlet gate.
Oh, God, please.
Don McCollum drills holes into the 4x4 steel plate flowage gate to bolt on a heavy chain. Chain's attached to a huge track hoe bucket. After several tries over the next hour, the rusted metal finally gives. Muddy water surges through this spillway, draining towards Osage Creek, a tributary to the Illinois River.
It's rip-roaring now.
That's Delia Hawk. She's executive director of the Illinois River Watershed Partnership. Her office is just across the street in a pale green concrete block building. They've been headquartered here for about a year since they purchased the 30-acre park for $880,000 with grants and donations. The place is a brand new name, Watershed Sanctuary at Cave Springs.
So as they drain the lake, they'll be able to not only build some fishing pier and a bridge and a boardwalk and renovate the raceways, but we'll be able to, more importantly, restore the habitat here to the more natural habitat in the lake bed as well as in the natural stream in front of the cave area.
A prolific cold water spring emerging from a deep cave complex in the forest to the east of us produces 6 million gallons of water per day. And once the lake bed is cleaned up and repaired, and after all the construction is finished, the reservoir will refill with that spring water, and a brand new flowage gate mechanism will be placed on it, by the way.
So it will be a reservoir. It will be drained for about a year to 15 months while construction is going on and for the lake bed to heal. But we will be filling it back up again and allowing fishing to go on here. And it will be the front area near the cave will be restored back to a more natural stream.
The Arkansas Natural Heritage Commission purchased the Cave Spring Reservation, as well as the forested bluffs above it, more than a decade ago to protect the endangered Ozark blind cavefish and a large colony of endangered gray bats which live inside the cave year-round from residential development. The cave's been locked and gated for years, and access to the entire park has been barred for some time. But now, the Illinois River Watershed Partnership is drawing up a master plan for a public environmental sanctuary in collaboration with the Arkansas Game and Fish Commission, who are matching the purchase price, covering facility construction costs.
There'll be two outdoor pavilions that will be able to accommodate 100 kids and adults in group activities. There will be a fishing pier built and a boardwalk. There will be what we're calling a cavevillion. It's a cave pavilion for kids to climb over and under and through and have a cave-like experience. There'll be a primary paved trail around the lake that will be ADA accessible. And we'll be working on the primitive trails up in the urban forest as well. So a lot of that will be going on as people go by every day and watch construction happen.
Delia Hawk says that AGFC plans to build a facility on the site, which it will share with Illinois River Watershed Partnership staff for watershed and conservation education. Now, the lake was first impounded with an earthen dam in 1852 for a grist mill. In 1947, E.L. Keith purchased the property and built a city park and trout hatchery to supply local restaurants. Most recently, the property was acquired by a developer who sought to sell it for $4 million. The Great Recession led to a default. The bank took possession and held it for several years until it was finally sold as a sanctuary. Standing next to the spillway, native Teresa Marchant Meredith remembers playing in Lake Keith Park as a child, and she's excited about all the changes here.
Love it. Absolutely love it. It's going to bring our town back to life. Back in the 50s, this was the happening place with cabins and hotel and swimming pool and skating rink and nice cafe. So it was a real happening place, and then it just kind of deteriorated.
Now Cave Springs residents anticipate a revival of their beloved city park, and everyone plans to attend the opening dedication of the Environmental Center, Teresa Meredith says. But for now, it will take about 24 hours for the lake to completely draw down, leaving behind the original spring-fed creek. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
To learn more, visit irwp.org.
If you were to pick up some of that mud on the bank of Lake Keith and place it under a microscope, you'd find a world of activity. Tiny microorganisms that offer insights to the structure of life. It was a similar patch of sediment, this one from Massachusetts, that started researchers with local connections to find a previously unidentified organism that may help connect branches on the tree of life. It's a story that's mostly science, but with a dash of whimsy thrown in.
My research lab deals mostly with anaerobic organisms.
Jeffrey Silberman is a professor of biological sciences at the University of Arkansas. He says one of the best places he knows to gather possible specimens of anaerobic organisms is Prince Cove in Martsons Mills, Massachusetts, where his mother lives.
So every time I'm up at my mother's house, I go down to the water and I scoop up some sediment and bring it down back to the lab in Arkansas and put that sediment into all sorts of different culture media and look for my target organisms, but also a whole slew of different types of organisms, some of which I've seen before, some of which I've never recognized before, come up in the culture media. And this is one of those organisms.
Jeffrey says he keeps little plastic screw top tubes with a milliliter of the sediment in the lab, and every few days he puts some under a microscope to observe the contents. Almost every time, he says, he sees something interesting. But one particular microorganism was very captivating.
I had never seen anything like it in my life. It's this little fast-swimming, flagellated organism that I've never seen in any textbook, in any manual on protistology, and it came up in great numbers, and I managed to, what I thought, get it into a culture where it was only by itself, no other protist or unicellular organisms in there. And every once in a while, I would see what I thought was a contaminant, which is an organism that I recognized. And I could never get that contaminant away. And it turns out that this particular organism has two morphological forms. One is this swimming form that I've never seen before, and one is this other form that I had seen before and have done some molecular and descriptive work on before.
Jeff's colleague, Matthew Brown, helped with the research. Matthew had earned his bachelor's and PhD at the University of Arkansas and was in Fayetteville when Jeffrey first saw the organism under the microscope. But he soon left for postdoc work in Halifax, Nova Scotia.
Jeff sent me the organism and some culture. I did some molecular diagnoses to actually see if it is more than one organism or test to see if it's actually just one organism. Since there is these two different morphologies, one morphology that looks like something that we recognize, and another morphology that looks like something that we don't recognize. So I did some molecular diagnoses to actually identify if it's actually one organism or two different organisms.
This odd new creature, invisible to the naked eye, is one organism. But the initial confusion gave way to a remarkable discovery through further research. This little organism is unicellular, but has an ancestral connection to life forms with more than one cell.
Not only does this unicellular organism tell us something about the toolkit that was involved in becoming multicellular, in a broader sense, it tells us about what are the ancestors of major lineages of eukaryotes might have looked like.
Matthew, now a professor at Mississippi State University in Starkville, is the lead author of the eventual study about the organism that has recently been published in Proceedings of the Royal Society B, one of the world's leading biological journals. Matthew says that genetic toolkit Jeffrey referred to inside this form of life gives new thought to the tree of life and just when certain multicellular branches on that tree began to sprout.
So it turns out that even this ancestor had some of those genes that we had originally thought were animal-specific. And in fact, the group that animals and fungi are in, they're a cohesive unit, but it turns out that a lot of the genes that are associated with these, with this multicellular toolkit were lost in the fungi. And so for a long time, people believed that there are a lot of genes that are animal-specific and fungal-specific. But what it turns out is that once you start to look at the ancestor of the group as a whole, you can actually find that there's more genes than what we really believed were. So it turns out they're not animal specific. They're actually specific to a much larger group.
The perhaps simplest way to understand what this discovery means, identifying a new organism that can be placed on the Tree of Life can help us better understand the entirety of the Tree of Life.
Absolutely.
Matthew Brown says this kind of study reinforces the knowledge that humans and other animals have more in common with tiny single-celled organisms like this one.
By identifying organisms that, you know, fall at the base of a major lineage that, you know, everyone understands and recognizes, fungi and animals, understanding actually what an ancestor of those looks like is really important, because it actually turns out that the organisms that we recognize, the animals and fungi, are actually derived characters even at the single cell stage.
If you want to know more about the science, and there's much more to know, you can go to royalsocietypublishing.org. I also mentioned some whimsy attached to this discovery. That comes with the organism's name. Again, Matthew Brown.
Pigsuia biforma.
Yes, you heard those first three syllables correctly. Remember, Matthew has 2 degrees from the University of Arkansas, and when he named the new organism, he merged a famous cheer from his alma mater with some mock Latin.
The organism itself actually looks like a little razorback under the microscope. So we had one of our colleagues that is actually a co-author on the paper. Whenever he was looking at it under the microscope, he was like, oh, this kind of looks like a little razorback, because he always made fun of me for being a razorback fan. So the way that we took Wu Pig Sui is we broke down and just used Pig Sui. And to refer to it looking like a pig and being small, I wanted to use the word pig, and I used I took PYG of pygmy, which is a mythical group of race of humans in Greek mythology. And I took so PYG for being small as the root of pygmy, and then Sua, which the group that the animal family that pigs are in are called the Suidae. And so I broke that down into Sui, and then just put an A at the end to make it sound more Latin. So it ends up being Pig Suia.
Jeffrey Silberman, the University of Arkansas professor who first collected the sediment containing the organism, says even more fun than naming the new organisms is the discovery itself. Does it ever feel overwhelming knowing that you'll never get to that there are these microorganisms that haven't been identified, may never, that we're walking on?
No, it's not overwhelming. It's satisfying.
This is Ozarks at Large. It is Wednesday, October the 2nd, 2013. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Callums.
I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
With us, Becca Martin-Brown, features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
How about some visual arts instead of zombies?
Prefer that.
We talked Halloween yesterday. Let's talk visual arts today.
Okay. New work by Kathy P. Thompson and Cindy Arcega.
Yeah.
On display through November 2nd at the Depot in Fayetteville. The opening reception is tomorrow night from 6 to 9. First Thursday is tomorrow night.
Yes.
With live music, street performers, children's activities in downtown Fayetteville. The Fayetteville Underground is featuring mixed media collage artist Rose DeSalvo Herzog, painter Carol Roberts, and mixed media sculptor Robert Lemming. And they have an open house tomorrow night during First Thursday. Mm-hmm. It's First Friday this week. Oh, I wish they'd get these all straightened out.
Well, they're straightened out. It's the first Thursday. It's the first Friday.
And then it's the third Thursday, right. And it's the fourth. I don't know. Oktoberfest, 11:30 to 1 and 5 to 8 in downtown Bentonville. Walker Landing Arts, make art outdoors on Walker Landing. This time with music by the Bentonville High School Jazz Band.
Fun.
Is 1 to 3 on the 6th. And the 5x5 exhibit, greatly anticipated by many of us who are collecting the Little Darlings, happens October 10th through November 6th at the Art Center of the Ozarks in Springdale. And on November 7th. Is when the soiree
yes.
happens. You can find out more at 751-5441.
Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin-Brown is features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Well, okay. Tell you what, you help me fix up this boat, keep it running, you can take it out anytime.
But then somebody would come up blubbering about our poor mom every time she'd get close. And then I'd try the same thing with no luck.
It was much easier to stand beside the football field, just as long as I was not the one having to engage in the physical devastation that was necessary to win the games.
Tales from the South, Saturday afternoon at 3:30 on KUAF.
When talking to local entrepreneurs, it's not unusual for them to credit family or friends for encouraging them to make the leap into the business world on their own. This is the story from Matt Feierabend, creator of Pure Joy Ice Cream, which is based in Siloam Springs. His story begins a few years ago when he and his wife, Megan, were looking for a way to help their friends, the Tugwells, who were adopting a little girl from China. Matt says his friends were about 2 months away from finishing the adoption, but they still had a substantial amount of money they needed to raise. Matt had been making ice cream at home for fun and decided he would put his hobby to good use.
And so we said, we could do our ice cream. Everybody keeps telling us they would buy our ice cream. And so I said, you know, I'm going to make everybody put their money where their mouth is. I'm going to sell the ice cream and see if they actually really like it that much. So we did. I think it was about 2 or 3 weeks. We just said, okay, we're going to do it on this Saturday, and we're going to sell it all day. We're going to do samples, and we pre-sold them. So we pre-sold them at $15 a pint, and we sold 200 pints of ice cream. And we got several additional donations on top of that and raised $5,000 in one day.
Matt says he grew up with a fondness for ice cream. His mom loved Baskin-Robbins, and Matt says he always wanted to try their craziest flavors. A few years ago, he decided to try making his own ice cream at home, and he requested an ice cream maker for Christmas.
At first, my ice creams were terrible. They were absolutely awful. And so I actually put the ice cream maker away for about 6 months. Didn't make a single batch. I had like 3 bad flavors, and I said, you know, maybe I'm no good at this. Maybe that was a bad idea. And so I put it away. I made the vanilla that my mom, her recipe, which is fantastic. And so I made that a couple times, but I didn't really do much. And we went on a trip and had some artisan ice cream at a place in Kansas City. And we had a goat cheese ice cream and a fresh mint ice cream made with mint leaves. And so those two flavors were like my first experience of artisan, you know, locally crafted style ice cream. And I was like, man, this is really good. I'm going to go home and figure this out.
Matt went home and looked up recipes online for guidance. Fast forward to the summer of 2011, and he used his newfound skills in the kitchen to help his friends raise money for their child's adoption. Following the successful fundraiser, his friends encouraged him to sell his ice cream more frequently. Matt was hesitant because of how much prep work it required, but said he would consider it if they could find a commercial ice cream machine that would freeze 2 to 3 gallons every 15 minutes. Matt says he was also resistant because he and his wife already had a photography and framing business. The food industry is not an easy one to be in, and it just wasn't something he was really interested in. Despite his doubts, his friends kept prodding and encouraging him to turn his hobby into a business. So Matt kept looking for machines and eventually found an affordable one in Fayetteville. The next hurdle was finding a commercial kitchen where they could produce the ice cream.
I don't know where we're going to put this thing. It needs 3-phase electric. It needs water hookups. It needs everything that you're not going to find in just any old building. And turns out there was a revitalization going on in Siloam Springs downtown, and they were remodeling a restaurant down there. And went to the owners, and I said, hey, what are the chances you'd let us put the ice cream in there? Expecting them to totally say, yeah, I don't know, we'll have to think about it, we'll have to talk about it. And they immediately just said yes. They immediately just said, yep, let's do it. And I actually had to be like, can we talk about the details? I think this is more than just a yes. And so they said, whatever you need, we'll make it happen. So we came up with a great agreement with them where they let us use the kitchen, and they get to use our machine. And so yeah, it's a really cool situation where we've everything just kind of fell in place. And I was standing there then going, I have an ice cream business. I never tried to. I never went out wanting to be in the food business or ice cream business, and now here I am.
28 Springs shares its kitchen with Matt, who only allows himself to spend one day each week on pure joy business. Another thing that carried over from the fundraiser into his new ice cream business was the name Pure Joy. Matt's wife came up with the name to honor the little girl their friends were adopting, Esther Joy, and the fact that they use pure ingredients. Another aspect of the business is 100% of profits go to orphan care. Specifically, the money is given to the Titus Task. The organization was created by Matt's friends in memory of a young boy they were trying to adopt from Haiti who died.
And unfortunately, the orphanage that they were, or that he was living in, was not feeding him. And so they were pocketing the money that they were getting and not feeding the kids. And so he passed away unnecessarily. There was no reason, no need. So they became really passionate about helping not only care for orphans, but also helping families who are trying to adopt, raise funds, just navigate the whole adoption process. And so they've just been a huge support through their organization, the Titus Task. They support families through grants, and they also support an orphanage in Haiti that does good, that actually takes care of the kids and does a lot of good stuff. So they moved down there just 2 or 3 months ago to be down there full time.
Pure Joy ice cream owner Matt Feierabend says he questioned if they could give 100% of their profits away and grow to be a sustainable business. He did some research and found that Newman's Own does it, so Matt decided to give it a try. During the year and a half the business has been open, Matt has never taken pay, and everything above operating costs is given to orphan care. While the profits may go to help orphans in other countries, Pure Joy's products are locally sourced, which helps farmers in the region.
Things like vanilla beans and coffee beans don't come from local sources. We can't grow them in Arkansas. But everything that we can get local, we get local. And those things that we do get from foreign producers, like coffee beans and vanilla beans, we work with companies that are trying to get them direct trade, fair trade, organically, things like that. So all of our coffee currently comes from Onyx Coffee Roasters in, they're in Northwest Arkansas. I was going to say in Springdale, they've got that location there. And we try to work with them to use their direct trade beans as much as possible. I have some ice cream that I brought. Actually, I have a new bean that they have that they did a direct trade where they bought the whole farm. Yeah, they bought the entire farm, and so it's the only place you can get it in the world. This exact bean is from Onyx Coffee Roasters in Northwest Arkansas.
That farm is located in Brazil, and you're likely to taste it when sampling Pure Joy's Cup of Joe. Some of the company's other flavors include Redhead Sorbet, Garden Mint Chip, Sweet Brown Vanilla, Rosemary and Peach, Midnight Mocha, and Happy Goat. This flagship flavor uses goat cheese from White River Creamery in Elkins and Canyon Ridge Farms near Tahlequah, while the honey comes from a farm in Lincoln. Using two sources of goat cheese is an example of how Matt is working to make the flavors less seasonal. He explains goat cheese is only available when the animals are breeding, so by dealing with farms that may breed at different times of the year, Pure Joy ice cream has the ability to produce its happy goat flavor for a longer period of time. Owner Matt Feierabend says one of the ways his ice cream gets its unique flavor is from preparing small batches of ice cream that are slow turned. The result is a thicker, heavier, creamier ice cream that people may not be accustomed to. Currently, Pure Joy ice cream is available at special events and by the scoop at Poor John's, a coffee shop in Siloam Springs. Matt is working with other coffee shops and restaurants in the area to stock his ice cream. His plan is to give them a limited supply and then send out a message via social media to inform the public of where they can find Pure Joy ice cream.
And hopefully people will race to the coffee shop safely and at proper speeds on the road. And the ice cream will sell out really quickly. Because our goal is not to have a lot of waste, especially since we do 100% of our profits. We don't want to have, you know, half of the pints that we deliver end up getting thrown away. So we want to keep it manageable. We want to keep it small and sell as much of it as possible and not have any waste.
Owner Matt Feierabend is working on raising money for a food truck, which he says would make it easier for his business to be more mobile. You can try some Pure Joy ice cream tomorrow evening at the Mustache Goods and Wares in Fayetteville during First Thursday. For more information on where else you can find his ice cream, you can visit facebook.com/purejoyicecream.
A bit of the new Theater Squared play, 4,000 Miles, in just a moment on Ozarks at Large. The University of Arkansas Student Alumni Association is partnering with the American Red Cross to host their annual blood drive from 11 until 8 today and tomorrow at the Hyper Building. Daniel McFarland, Vice President of the Student Alumni Board and Homecoming Director, says the UA Homecoming Blood Drive officially began in 2010 as a competition for homecoming events. Last year, 1,300 units of blood donated. The blood drive is open to the public, and those interested in donating can attend the event or make an appointment at redcrossblood.org. And Haas Hall Academy in Fayetteville also hosting a blood drive tomorrow from 11 until 2. More information about that blood drive available at haashall.org.
Ozarks at Large is sponsored in part by the University of Arkansas Women's Giving Circle, whose mission is to transform and expand women's giving to university programs and research through a collective voice. The AMP Arkansas Music Pavilion presents ZZ Top this Friday. This classic rock trio will perform a span of hits dating back 40 years. Tickets and more information are available at amptickets.com or 443-5600.
The second production of the Theater Squared season, 4,000 Miles, opened last weekend and will continue with more performances beginning tomorrow night and running through October 13th. The play, written by Amy Herzog, won the 2012 Obie Award for Best New American Play and was a finalist for the 2013 Pulitzer Prize. The script has at its heart the relationship between a young man, Leo, and his 91-year-old grandmother, Vera. Leo has experienced a terrible loss during a cross-country bike trip, and he's come to his grandmother's apartment in New York City. Last night, two of the cast members, Susan Greenhill and Michael Holding, participated in a discussion with me about the play at the Fayetteville Public Library. Robert Ford, the artistic director of Theater Squared, was also on hand. Both actors are making their Theater Squared debut. I asked Susan last night about playing a 91-year-old character on stage, a character far older than the actor.
To play 91, I observed, I observed my folks very carefully and thought about which aspects I would bring in for Vera. So my dad has a particular spine thing that affects the way he walks. So I thought that Vera would do that. My mom has a particular way of getting up and out of a chair and down, and so all these things are kind of particular to me that I've taken from people who are very much involved. I'm involved with in the whole aging process, and so and then I relied on Shauna and other two. You know, tone it down a little, make it a little more specific, see who needed what, where. But there's also a kind of, depending on what you're wearing, can determine an awful lot. So I kind of knew what clothing they should put me in.
Leo, this play rises or falls with the relationship that you have. I called you Leo, but it rises and falls with the relationship Leo has with his grandmother. What was it like the first time the two of you, who knew you'd be spending so much stage time together, the first time you met? Was it upon your arrival here?
First time we met was at the read-through.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, when we did the read-through together, the first read-through, the first rehearsal, kind of perfect, I thought. Okay. I was just like, this moment's perfect. I think this our rapport already is kind of in place a little bit. And so it just kind of worked out really well.
And it's just funny, that kind of, for me, oh, hi, nice to meet you. You're my grandson. I love you deeply. Or, hi, you're my husband. I hate you. You know?
Well, the next day, we went to the gym together, didn't we?
Yeah.
The next day.
Yeah.
Spent some grandson time at the gym.
Mm-hmm. And I would go into the gym to say, oh, your grandson's been here, or when's he coming? And it's not like we arranged to go together. We just found ourselves there. So we've bonded over the Stairmasters.
We're going to hear a scene, right? I'd say a sneak preview, but it's already open. But we can, for the people who haven't seen it yet, it's a preview. What scene will we see or hear?
Well, we're going to see a little bit, hear a little bit from the second scene in the play. So the first scene, we see his Leo's arrival at his grandmother's West Village apartment in the wee hours of the morning. And then this is the next day, I think.
Morning
and
after.
We're cutting into the scene a little bit. So just to kind of give you a flavor of how their relationship is developing, but it's very early on. One of the great things about this play is this playwright is she understands what can be done visually, and there are a couple of visual jokes, and one of them involves, and I think I'm not sure they can say this word on the air.
Well,
a box of male prophylactics. Which Vera is going to refer to very early on when she holds up this box and says something about them, and then we're going to go on with the scene. So we're not going to the end of the scene. I'm just going to take a little bit out of the middle.
You drank coffee?
Oh, yeah, I'd love some.
I'm glad to see you carry those, and surprised they weren't opened. I thought you'd probably take it black.
I do.
Mm-hmm. Me too. That's how I like it. Oh. Tell me if that's completely thawed.
Mm-hmm.
I got a few of those free a month or two ago at the senior center. Some event, they were had a buffet table, and at the end, they were going to throw it all away, which I do not agree with. And it's lucky I thought to freeze them, because otherwise I would have had to go out and get you something, and I really wasn't feeling completely up to it. Oh, some days I'm myself. Some days my head really isn't right, and my balance, it's really disgusting.
Have you had it checked out?
What? Oh, sure, they're all useless. They just tell me I'm old, and I knew that already. I knew you were sleeping well, because you didn't wake up when I brought your, what do you call it, out of your room, moaning and groaning. That thing must weigh 100 pounds.
Nah, about 20.
Is that all?
Well, it's one of four bags. Total weight's about, 50.
You keep all that on your bicycle, 50 pounds?
Yep.
And you keep all that on your bicycle?
Yeah.
Well, doesn't that make it a lot harder?
Yes. Yeah. That's a yes. Yeah.
And you camp at night, is that it?
Yeah, usually. Sometimes I'd meet someone and be invited to crash.
You ever meet anyone really peculiar?
What do you mean?
Well, like, I don't know, some crackpot who wanted something weird from you in exchange for a place to stay or whatever.
Like,
I don't know, something sexual.
What?
I would think on the road like that by yourself, you'd meet all kinds of people.
Yeah, I did meet all kinds of people. None of them required sexual favors from me, no.
Well, if you were a woman, it probably would have been different. You probably would have run into all kinds of things.
I know
like
a lot
that.
Of women who travel alone. Beck has done a lot of traveling.
Rebecca, well, all right, if you're built like that, but I mean a small woman.
I find if you approach people with love and trust, you can count on getting the same things back from them.
Michael Holding and Susan Greenhill with a snippet from the play 4,000 Miles, written by Amy Herzog. Michael is from Chicago, Susan is from New York City, and they are the leads in the current production of Theater Squared staging of Herzog's play 4,000 Miles. We heard excerpts from a panel discussion last night at the Fayetteville Public Library that was devoted to the play. We also heard the voice of Bob Ford, the artistic director of Theater Squared. 4,000 Miles will have productions again this weekend, beginning tomorrow night and running through Sunday evening, and again Thursday through Sunday, the weekend that ends October 13th. You can find tickets and learn much more at theater2.org.
I'm Robin Young. Next time on Here and Now, through the Cooking Channel show My Grandmother's Ravioli, Mo Rocca is learning family recipes from different cultures.
The biggest area of common ground among grandparents all over the world is the refusal to measure.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Here and Now, coming up next here on KUAF 91.3 FM. KUAF is supported by the Walmart Visitor Center Museum. This newly remodeled and expanded center is family-friendly and features two interactive galleries, plus the Walton's Five and Dime 1950s-style soda fountain. Located on the square in downtown Bentonville and open daily until 9 p.m. 277-8493 or facebook.com/Walmart Visitor Center Museum for more information. Support for KUAF comes from Edible Oz, Arkansas. This quarterly magazine focuses on food, farms, and culture in the Ozarks. Proceeds will benefit hunger relief efforts through Feed Fayetteville and Feed Communities. More information, including subscriptions, available at edibleozarkansas.com.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Rogers, Marble.
Remind me again where Marble is.
Marble's in Madison County, like, as you're on 45 headed east.
Like, it's like in the middle. Like,
yeah.
I know if you give me a map, I can point.
It's before, if you were leaving Fayetteville, if you were leaving Northwest Washington County and headed towards Huntsville, you would go through Marble before you got to Huntsville.
Perfect.
And if you were leaving Huntsville, conversely, the other way, you'd hit it before you go to Fayetteville. Yes.
Busy week?
Yes. A lot of work. I'll be in Benton County today doing some stories there. And
looking forward to that.
Yes, I am. Had the forum last night at the library.
Mm-hmm.
And there are other things.
Oh, well, there's always something
there
else.
There are always other things.
Always busy. And the thing that I found with being so busy is people ask me if I've listened to the show or heard a story on the show. And I feel like we kind of have a joke here that we hear it the least of anyone.
Yes.
Because the minute we do the show, we're working on the story for the next day.
Which is why we're constantly mixed up, seriously, here, day it is. In the afternoon, we're usually a day ahead.
Mm-hmm, because we've already done, say, today's show, Tuesday,
right.
And we already think it's, or Wednesday's show. Jeez, there I go.
Right, there
Wednesday's
you go.
Show, and I already think it's Thursday, or it's just very confusing. But what I really like, and what I figured out, sort of because I kind of busted my radio in my car again, and so I've been listening to things on my phone.
Right.
And I figured out, thanks to my boyfriend, how to do like podcasts on your phone. And I realized that we have a podcast.
Yes.
Which I did not realize. I thought we just had it through the KUAF app. But apparently that is not true. So I feel like I should share this with people.
Yes, you can get the podcast through iTunes, the Ozarks at Large podcast.
Right. So I downloaded the app, the podcast apps, and then you search for
podcasts.
And I found Ozarks at Large.
And you can set it up to subscribe, which means it's as soon as we have it prepared online, iTunes takes it and makes it available to you and can just put it in your phone ready for you.
Right.
And of course, you can also listen to us online
at ozarksatlarge.com
or KUAF.com.
And that's at KUAF.com, that's the live stream if you can't catch us on the radio.
Right.
And because we're on at noon and 7, Monday through Friday.
Also now on at 5 on KUAF HD3.
Right. And again, you can listen to us on an HD radio. If you don't have an HD radio, you can listen at KUAF.com.
You can also listen on our app, which is available on smartphones.
Yes. You can get the KUAF app, and Ozarks at Large is one of the little buttons at the bottom that you can click on, and it'll update the shows for you, and you can listen to it there.
All free.
And you can do all of those things.
So all
just
of that.
Letting everybody know.
A production of KUAF 91.3 FM. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
Thanks for listening.